I'm Jim Benson, and you're listening to TV Time Machine on Intelligent Talk, 1170 KCBQ. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and visit our show archives at tvtimemachine.com.
I bought this portable black and white set known as a jet light in 1965 by selling Christmas cards. I'm determined to find a dealer who can fix it.
Today on the TV Time Machine, we ask you to adjust your vertical hold as we open a window to the past in search of TV Man. In this edition of our program, we are pleased to welcome Steve Kosareff, writer, producer, director of the documentary TV Man, The Search for the Last Independent Dealer. Mr. Kosareff is a television archivist and author of the book Window to the Future, whose documentary takes us on a warm and funny adventure as he valiantly searches for the last TV repairman and independent dealer in America. Over the next segment, Steve Kosareff will not only help us explore virtually every aspect of his nostalgic documentary, appearing in select theaters and available soon on DVD, but will also talk about how his film tunes in to larger issues that go beyond the small screen. Again, for those of you intrepid enough not to change the channel, feel free to put on your rabbit ears as we shut down our flat screen of the present to warm up our cathode ray tube of the past. Steve, thank you for coming on board the TV Time Machine.
Thanks, Jim. My pleasure.
Steve, you're the writer, producer, and director of TV Man, The Search for the Last Independent Dealer, now playing at the Monica Four Theater in Santa Monica, California through September 12th. Steve, tell us the premise of TV Man and what gave you the idea to create this documentary.
Well, it's basically about the little mom-and-pop shops that sold and serviced sets, primarily in the 1950s and 60s. And oddly enough, some of these guys are still around, though they're struggling. And I have a little black and white Zenith portable jet-like TV that I bought when I was 14 selling Christmas cards in 1965. It's a 1966 model set. And I had it stuck in a closet for about 30 years. As you see in the film, it's pulled out, and the thing doesn't work. So now we decide to try and find somebody locally to fix it. But unfortunately, as it turns out, there really isn't a dealer around to do it, even though I make a major effort, as you see in the film, and it's very fun because of the dealer that we try and find. So we decide to go ahead and do a 1,000-mile road trip after I find some other dealers up in the Pacific Northwest. And in the process of each dealer trying to fix it, they tell their war stories about, you know, people shooting their set.
I go, well, was shot.
And she goes, no, it fell over on something sharp. I go, twice? Because it had two bullet holes in it.
And we're going, you know, they don't warranty a set with a bullet hole in it. Well, he actually turned us in to the Bureau of Electronic Repairs. They found for that customer, and we had to do an $800 pitcher tube job.
We're going into a home, and the wife is standing there nude while they're working on it. Or worse yet, propositioning them. It's very funny. The guys are great characters. And, you know, we had a lot of fun making it.
Well, anybody who's aware of creating and filming a documentary knows how much dedication and work it takes. How many years did you put into TV Man?
I'm going to say, without actually looking at my paperwork, probably about five from the time I started developing it. It actually evolved, has a lineage that dates back to 1998. When I tried to actually developed a television set museum project, the U.S. does not have a large television set museum. There's a small one in Hilliard, Ohio, a couple other smaller ones across the country, and even the one that's probably most famous, the MZTV Museum in Toronto, is
right.
Very small. So I, you know, developed this proposal, you know, shipped it around to TV producers who had made their fortunes in the industry and got an underwhelming response. You know, I had a couple like Dick Clark who said, well, you know, once you get it off the ground, we'll give you some money and or items. And so I had done all this research, and I thought, well, you're probably the next thing, logical thing, is a book. So I created a manuscript, was tipped off that Chronicle Books might be interested, and sent it up there. And an editor spotted it and then called me and said, well, we don't want to do a text-heavy book. We're sort of interested in the midsection, which has a lot of illustrations. And I said, well, I think I know what you want. I sent them a manuscript and a revised manuscript, and basically they ended up publishing that in 2005 as Window to the Future. You see the book briefly at the beginning of TV Man, and the book has lavish ads it's illustrated with that show how TV sets were, you know, sold and marketed to the public. And I got to thinking, well, you know, people saw these ads and then went into the dealers. What happened once they went into the dealers? And that sort of became the genesis for TV Man, the film.
What aspect of this production was the most difficult for you?
Let's see. Probably money.
I thought you were going to say that.
You know, this was a little different than a lot of documentaries. When you have an issue-oriented one that sort of pulls at, you know, people's heartstrings, it's a little easier for them to you know, open their pocketbooks up.
Right.
And this was not that. It was not an issue-oriented one, and was one that a lot of people, there's a whole couple generations out there that know nothing about this, that didn't grow up with it. And so I was sort of, you know, treading a new territory, but, you know, I wanted to go ahead and do it. And so basically the film was financed by myself, family, and friends. And even though I did try to raise substantial fundings out from outside sources, it just didn't happen. And so as I got money and then, you know, did what I needed to with the film, and then, you know, I would try to raise funds outside or hit family up or something. So the thing had a very stop and start kind of up and down period of time over the last couple of years, even though we shot the bulk of the footage in 2009. And though I had certain things mapped out, I didn't have the complete story till I was actually looking at the footage, you know, to see where this was going and to see where my beginning and then the end of the movie was. And and there was an incident, which you do see at the end of TV Man, I don't want to reveal it, which actually occurred during the post-production of the film, which actually helped give us an ending to it. And, you know, so that's sort of where it was.
So when you do a documentary, even if you do have an ending in mind, that may not necessarily come to fruition. How much of TV Man was developed over time and in the editing room specifically?
We did a first cut of the film last year, ran for about 100 minutes, and we actually did it for an invited select group of people. We handed out comment cards, and based on those comment cards, which are really good, we went ahead and started to recut the film, to tighten it, to shorten it, and there were also some legal things we had to remove and substitute some other clips. There were creative things as we were building, and as you get into it and you start digging, you start to see certain things that you don't normally do when you're shooting something, or you know. And so the film sort of opens in up itself, and what you really want to do is follow what the film is telling you. You really don't want to force sort of a false ending or story on it. And because this wasn't an issue-oriented film, it wasn't clearly cut. You know, there were no bad and good guys necessarily, and they're in. It was just sort of wide open. There were many ways we could have gone with this film, and actually the LA Times, which was not a great review, pointed out some things, but he was pointing at films that I wasn't planning on making at this point. And, you know, I was aware we could have gone in other directions, but for a first film about the subject matter, I really wanted to have it be pretty light and reach as many people as possible, and I didn't want to do very pointed, specific, a targeted kind of thing, which I saw that we could have done, and which the LA Times reviewer pointed out.
Right, because you could have taken a more hard-hitting approach. You could have done a sort of a Roger and Me, Michael Moore thing, where it exposes the underbelly of corporate America and that sort of thing, and you didn't take that approach.
No, we didn't want to, and, you know, it's really, I'm not really Michael Moore in that sense, and I really think you get much more out of people, particularly the dealers we were interviewing, if they feel that you're sort of on their side and friendly. And we had, the people that we chose were, first of all, good. They also reacted naturally. The people that you see on the screen, that's how they actually are. And you don't get talking heads in that sense. These people are very lively, they're very funny. And I really think that everybody has a story to tell, and these guys were just waiting to tell their stories, and I just happened to walk in the door, and it just all came out. And, you know, and it's, I was surprised. I was surprised at the questions I asked them, you know. And I had some things printed on paper, but I just sort of winged it, and, you know, I was surprised at what I asked them, and I was surprised at their responses. So it's very of the moment. And even dealing with the surprise when the TV set is first opened up, which I don't want to give away here, and I don't want you to because you've seen the film, But that was not staged. That actually happened as you see it. And you know, it pays off for the film.
Yes, tell us about some of the TV dealers that are featured in TV Man, and what were some of your favorite moments when you were interviewing them?
Well, they're all different. It's interesting, even though they have television sets, generally, at least sales, if not repair, as part of their their service, they are all different, and yet they do have some things in common. The first one that we went to was Poma TV. Strictly sells television sets, not appliances or anything else. It's owned by Bruce and Dave Poma in Ukiah, California, which is a former logging town.
Right.
And these guys inherited the business from their father, who passed away in the mid-'80s. And he had actually changed the location 5 times, as you see in the film. And, you know, they had a very thriving business, but the Internet is starting to cut into their sales, as you see in the film. And big box stores are playing a part, and we talk about that a little bit in the movie. The next dealer I think we went to was Hutchins TV and Appliance in Hillsboro. The store has been in the same location, but it's had 3 owners. It's owned by Jim and Susie Swanson, a middle-aged couple with several children who work in the business. And what's interesting, and one of the things we didn't talk about in the film, that they basically have 1 TV set for sale, a demo model in their showroom. Now, what they do is basically personal shop. So they will ask people either on the phone or in the store what they're looking for a television set. And they will go ahead and purchase that set and install it for their client that way. So here's a store that did sell television sets, barely sells them now, mostly appliances, but they do have a long history with television, and we have the previous owner there who has some great stories to tell. We then go to a distributor, EDI, Electrical Distributing, Inc., in Portland. They had been a Zenith television and radio distributor for 61 years.
Wow.
The first Zenith radios that came out. And this company was even spun out of another company which sold horse harnesses in the 1880s in Portland. So you're looking at still a family-owned business. There's 5 generations who've run this family, and the third-generation manager, Bubby Cronin, who's basically semi-retired now, he's in his 80s. We have some great archival footage of him with the 1964 line of Zenith color TVs. Beautiful. If you ever love those console color TVs,
oh yeah,
he's in a white linen suit, and he's showing these things off, and it's just amazing footage. And you see him today, and we talked to him about his Zenith distributorship. And one of the nice things, over the years, he collected Zenith television sets and radios, and he has a little museum that's private in his warehouse, and he took us on a great tour of the sets. We show a little of it in the film. There'll probably be a more extensive footage on supplemental material for home video. But just amazing stuff. And Jim and Susie Swanson actually tipped me off to him. I wasn't even aware of him. And so we ended up visiting with him. We drive as far north as Chehalis, Washington, to the northernmost dealer, which is Central TV and Appliance. And they do still sell TVs. And the owner, Walt Swart, his widow, now runs the business. And we have former and current employees who are just a hoot. And Walt himself is a character. And even though he's no longer alive, once you hear the stories about him from these people, you will actually feel like you know him. And this guy, just to give you a sense of what he was like, is that there was a bank next door to the main store. He decided he wanted to acquire that property. And there was, I think, a 3-foot-thick concrete wall. Well, he rents a jackhammer and gives it to his employees to basically jackhammer through this wall like they're breaking out of prison. Now, as you can imagine, this didn't take a couple hours or even a couple days. It was a week. And as one of the former accounting people there says, there was white concrete dust over appliances years later. So that'll give you some sense of his type of person he was.
Yeah, that's the type of story that I don't think you would get from the general manager of Best Buy, for instance.
No.
when you were talking to these people, what impressed you most?
Their love for the business and each other, you know, and the community. They are embedded when you're in a small town, you know, for, say, 50, 60 years. You know, everybody knows you,
right,
and you know everybody.
This isn't a television and appliance store, yet it is part of the community. I'm here because this is a family-owned business. That's why I want to buy from you. One gentleman is coming from, I think he's on the other side of Portland. He came in and he said, I was looking for a family-run business.
We would work together. You know, if somebody was looking for an RCA, you'd say, well, Jerry has RCA and he's over on this corner.
And as you see in at Palma TV in Ukiah, California, there's people sitting out front, a little bench. There is a handicapped woman in a wheelchair who comes into their store all the time and plays with the remotes. And the Palma brothers are playing football over her head. I mean, it's an odd vision, and it's in the film. But this is the kind of thing that happens in these stores, you know.
Well, you mentioned the big box stores and the internet having an impact on independent TV dealers. What are some of the other reasons why they're suffering and going out of business?
Well, you know, in the old days, in the 50s up to probably the 60s, you know, the television sets were tube-based, and tubes are like light bulbs that burn out frequently. And so when you had a television set in your home during that time, you had a repairman probably coming in every couple months to work on it. And you saw the TV set repairman, you probably had a relationship with him, pretty much like a plumber or anybody else who would make house calls to work on your home. And, you know, primarily since the late 70s, as the sets have gotten more computer-like and less, you know, tube-like, they work, you know, you have less repairs, and people just tend to dispose of them. And so that sort of killed the repair business for them, and they buy them less frequently. Early on with black and white and into color television, people would buy multiple sets or replace them, you know, every couple years. And you don't necessarily have that anymore. I had Sony XBR set that I bought in, I think, 88, 89, and that thing ran for almost 20 years. Mm-hmm. And though it was a CRT, you know, cathode ray tube based, the thing just never broke down. And so, you know, you can see there, I didn't replace it, didn't have to have it fixed. So if there was a local dealer to my home, I wouldn't have been visiting them on a regular basis because of that.
I think the biggest thing that younger people and this current generation will never experience is the fact that our generation growing up actually created a relationship with our appliances because they were such a long part of our lives. Is that one of the things that your film conveys?
Yeah, as you know, as I have a lobby display at the Monica Four right now, and it's a 1952 Admiral Telebar. It's one of the most expensive sets that was ever made, sold for $900, which would be like $5,000 or $6,000 now. And I have that in the lobby with a couple period mannequins dressed in evening clothes celebrating New Year's Eve 1952. And as people go in and out of the theater, and if I'm around and they stop by, they say, you know, I remember my first TV set, and it's sort of like, you know, embedded in their mind, it's like burned in their memories. It's one thing that they'll never forget, the first time they saw television or their first television set their parents bought. And, you know, this is from decades ago. And it's not just men, it's women. Everybody who lived basically the baby boomer generation, they all remember their first TV set.
So, Steve, what do you think your film says about how the world has changed and how,
well, a lot.
And how business has changed over the years?
Well, it's very, you know, we live in a very impersonal age, and it continues to be so as more people stick their heads into digital devices and, you know, for information, for friendship, for relationships. People don't have to leave their homes, and they can be anywhere. They can be by themselves. You know, when we were growing up, generally there was maybe one or two television sets in a home. People watched as families often, and the programming choices were less. So the culture of television was different then. And, you know, generally also, too, there was two-parent families. The mother often didn't work. And so all that sort of impacted viewing of television and that kind of thing. And it impacts the sales of the sets, too, because like I said, we would go to our regular dealer to pick up a set or have it repaired. They would keep going back. Now, some of these dealers do get old, you know, younger generations coming back saying their grandfathers or their great-grandfathers or their great-great-grandfather bought a set. Jim and Susie Swanson talk about that at their dealership. But often people are just in a hurry, and, you know, they all they have to do is go to the Internet and hit a couple keys and pick something up there. But you don't really see what you're buying, and you have to deal with it. If you have to return it, it's got to be mailed back. It's really not good. And these big box stores tend to get you, they want to get your money and get you out of the door, and that's basically it. Dealers, I believe it's Poma, talks about how, you know, they don't, you know, they've got their, these big box stores have their TVs discounted, but if you want it installed or you want it serviced, they add all that cost back in, where Poma and these other small dealers, their price includes installation, removing your old TV. You can call them basically any hour night or day, and they will deal with you personally on the phone. There is just, that it's just moving away from that so much, and you know, we're sort of becoming desensitized, I think, and definitely less social because we don't have to face people to do things.
What were the attitudes of these TV dealers, knowing that they were dinosaurs and they were a dying breed, and how were they handling that?
You know, not well. They're sort of just hanging in there, and they really don't seem, you know, they're sort of boxed into what they do because most of them do not do additional Internet sales on their own. And depending on where they're located and whether they sell appliances in addition to that, they're struggling.
And this place was packed. And I can remember taking deposits down to the bank for them. It had like $20,000 in it, you know?
Of course, nowadays, as we sell a TV, we don't see someone for a decade or further unless they need another TV.
And we're like on the lowest, you know,
the lowest rung of society.
Right, yeah, I mean.
People don't appreciate the service as much anymore.
Yeah, we're kind of an old dying breed, you know.
And as you see at the end of the film, one of the dealers actually goes under. And I don't want to tell you which one that is, and because it's very much of an impact once you get to know these dealers by watching the film. And it is sad to see that happen.
Well, of course, we talked about how these dealers, how they're dealing with their struggling businesses and how that's affected their lives. How has this project affected your life?
You know, it's taken a lot of it to work on one film for 5 years, but, you know, on a personal project, when you're motivated like this and you think there's a story worth telling that people should know, you know, the payoff is having people laugh in an audience. And the film is very funny, and I love being in an audience listening to people laugh at it and get it and enjoy it and thank God I didn't know any of this before, you know.
Right.
And for people who love documentaries and particularly popular culture and history, American history, this is just something that I haven't seen touched on. And I'm hoping it's the first of a series of films about television and culture.
So outside of the audience reaction, how are the reviews for TV Man so far?
We've got some pretty good reviews. Trustmovies.org did an excellent review. The guy got the film. Hollywood Reporter and Variety have given a thumbs up. And so, you know, we're getting some good press here, and those are nationally syndicated. So other venues, other websites are picking up and posting those across the country. I think the Hollywood Reporter, I can't remember, the Variety Review in a Palm Beach, Florida paper.
Wow.
The Chicago Tribune, I think, has picked up the L.A. Times review.
That's great.
I think the Variety Review in a Glendale, California paper. So yeah, it's spreading across the country and actually the world. I've actually seen some international sites that have picked up the Hollywood Reporter and Variety Reviews. So the, you know, slowly we're building a base of recognition for the film out there. And, you know, as we get it out there in theaters and other media venues, you know, people will at least be hopefully aware of the name and know a little bit about the film.
Steve, what is the future for TV Man? Will people be able to see it outside of California soon?
Oh, yeah. We're looking looking at. I actually have it entered in the Chicago International Film Festival. I will actually find out about that the day after the run-ins in Santa Monica. There is a major Zenith radio and TV connection, not only in TV Man, but Chicago, where Zenith Radio and TV was headquartered. And you actually see archival footage that was shot in the city. You see the vice president of sales, who was headquartered in Chicago. So there is a major Chicago connection. Chicago also had other major manufacturers like Motorola building TV sets there, and they were often in the Midwest because it was sort of a central location for shipping the sets out around the country. Los Angeles does have, or did have, some television set manufacturing here. Hoffman TV was; those were built in Los Angeles. Packard Bell was built in West LA. There was even a tube manufacturing plant not too far away from my house in Santa Monica. So it was a major industry in this country. We had 100 American television set manufacturers in the 1950s. Now there are none.
And your film also spotlights that fact, that our trade policies as a nation impacted this industry. How did that work?
Well, you know, we still have the automobile, American automobile industry, fortunately. But pretty much during the 60s and 70s, the federal government allowed, had a laissez-faire attitude about imported television sets. So we had a lot of Asian imports. And there was actually a Japanese cartel of six companies that banded together and started selling their sets on American shores for less than they would cost to manufacture just to get a foothold here. And the government, you know, didn't do anything. Zenith was screaming. They filed a couple of injunctions. And even RCA was making matters worse by licensing all the technology to the Japanese. So basically, we opened the door, gave them the technology, and that just set up the destruction of the American television set industry here. Had that not happened, we still might be manufacturing television sets here. And obviously because Japanese and Koreans and so on found cheaper ways to manufacture sets, that was a final blow, even though Zenith, among others, they moved their manufacturing, even though their corporate headquarters were here, they moved their manufacturing initially to Mexico and then offshore, and by that time it was pretty much the end, and they folded up and sold out to LG, I think, in 95.
You mentioned before also the potential of the DVD. What is the timeline for the DVD for TV Man?
Well, probably a typical window. You know, once we've exhausted the theatrical venues, then it would go into, obviously, video on demand and streaming and then home video, you know, Blu-ray and DVD. The film is widescreen format. It has a full-channel sound, which is somewhat unusual for a documentary, and it really pays off with the music that you hear. We have some great music that we use in the film, yeah. We have French group Dionysus. We use actually clips of five of their songs, including for the open and ending credits. We have a little of Hank Ballard and the Midnighters, Finger Poppin' Time, and even some Carousel music in there for the parade sequences, which is a lot of fun. So you'll be tapping your toe when you come to see the film.
Steve, where can people find out more about yourself and TV Man online?
Well, they can go to tvman.tv, and we have the poster, we have the film's trailer on there, we've got the background on the film there, pretty much everything for the film on that. And for the book Window to the Future, which is basically out of print now, but enough people contact Chronicle Books, they'll reprint it. They can do a search for that or under my name.
TV Man, the search for the last independent dealer, now playing at the Monica Four Theater in Santa Monica, California through September 12th. Steve, it's been a tremendous pleasure having you aboard the TV Time Machine. Feel free to join us again in the future or in the past.
Thank you, Jim.